After Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and Pinocchio, we are now in the midst of the golden era of Disney animation. And now we're going to look at a film that's very different, that's not really about a narrative, but more about the marriage of art and music and animation and all these things. So this week we're going to learn how this idea for a little short starring Mickey Mouse turned into the fantastic feature known as Fantasia. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 3 of the World of Disney Animation. This is Mike Minotti. I'm joined by my brother, Aj Guy, or AJ Minotti.
Wrong podcast.
We're being a little professional here.
Yes.
No nicknames. So, hi, everyone. Yeah, now we're on Fantasia, which is a super exciting film to talk about. There's a lot to talk about with Fantasia.
It's the longest animated film, and this might be the longest episode of this podcast.
It's complicated. Well, we'll see. But yeah, we have a whole lot of things to talk about here, from the production and just, you know, kind of interesting little factoids. A lot of neat trivia with Fantasia. Really, its release is really interesting, and the way it's kind of been edited throughout the years. And then we're going to kind of talk about the film. We'll go segment by segment and kind of say what we think about it. And then we'll look at the way Fantasia influenced the parks, which is a pretty hefty, because it's like each segment almost kind of has its own presence somewhere in the parks, really. So yeah, we're going to get right into things with talking about the production and the origins of this idea. I kind of want to start off with the definition of a Fantasia, which actually is a real word. It's not something that Disney created. And a Fantasia is a composition in fanciful or irregular form or style. Which isn't 100% what Fantasia is, since, you know, it uses pretty traditional compositions of these scores, but it's fanciful and irregular more in a way with the marriage of the art and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So the roots of Fantasia obviously goes back to the Silly Symphonies, which in their way are kind of already doing what Fantasia wants to do. You know, if you look at the Silly Symphonies, and a lot of it is just marrying music and animation. The big idea came when, you know, towards the end of the 30s, Mickey Mouse was kind of beginning to lose his popularity. A lot of it, he was losing his popularity to Donald Duck, who was becoming the rising star. And even people like Dopey and the Three Pigs, stuff like that. So Mickey wasn't quite the marquee character he once was. You know, he still was Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
But Walt Disney thought, you know, let's do something to kind of elevate Mickey Mouse back up. So they come up with this idea for the Sorcerer's Apprentice, and it's going to be a sort of super silly symphony, I guess would be a good way of
putting it. And originally, wasn't Dopey considered Sorcerer's Apprentice?
Yeah, that was like one thing too they're saying, like, well, why even do Mickey? Dopey's so popular right now. Because they're planning this like in 37, right when Snow White comes out.
And I swear, like, you know, I know you're going to talk about the redesign in a moment here, but or later, I guess when we go whenever. But a lot of Mickey's facial expressions remind me of Dopey in the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Well, it's that era of where we're getting at there. I think Fred Moore does the redesign. I think he might have. I'm not sure, but I think he did animate a lot of the dwarves. I think he might have done Dopey. So now I need to look at that. No, I'm not sure, but I know he animated dwarves. I'm just saying things. But for things we do know about, because we researched them. So Walt Disney meets Leopold Stokowski at a old Hollywood restaurant called Chasen's, which actually just closed in like 96 or 95 or something. Oh, wow. So for a long time. And he tells Stokowski about this idea, and he's very enthusiastic about it. So things kind of become more ambitious when the production costs for the Swords of Prince go up and up and up. And it's like, well, we're not going to really make our money back. We just sell this as its own short. So let's make more to go with this, and we'll kind of make a feature out of it with the working title of the concert feature for a long time. So let's talk about some of the big players here. Leopold Stokowski, who we said is going to conduct Fantasia. Now, he was the conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra. He started at 1912 there. So he's already been there for a while.
And he's pretty well known throughout the country at this point.
Well, in musical circles, for sure. Yeah. For sure. He's known for his freehand conducting style, so he doesn't use a baton when he waits. So, and you see that in the movie. And he actually also and provided his own orchestrations for the Toccata and Fogue. I listened to this all day when I watched the movie. The first segment, Toccata and Fugue. How do you pronounce it?
Fugue.
we're very cultured here. It's going to get worse when we get to all the Russian names.
I'm okay at those.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah. The first segment, Toccata and Fogue, or Fugue in D minor, and the Night in Bald Mountain / Ave Maria segments. So those are his orchestrations. The other kind of important character here is Deems Taylor. He's the film's master of ceremonies, the narrator. So he's really the only voice you hear, except for like the Ave Maria singing. He's the only voice you hear throughout the movie. He was a music critic and a composer himself. That was part.
So this would be like Leonard Maltin doing a little bit, movie thing today.
A little bit, but he actually is like a composer. And he did commentary during the radio broadcast of the New York Philharmonic, which is kind of why people knew his voice. So, Walt gets him brought into the fold. And then, so really, it's Taylor, Stokowski, and Walt who kind of work together to pick the music for Fantasia, with some other people from the studio involved. So those are kind of the three big names getting involved here. Walt with the creative lead, and Stokowski and Taylor with sort of the music pedigree, especially when they're picking music very early on. Walt, you know, admits he's not a music critic. He can't offer necessarily a whole lot, but, you know, he kind of comes up with the ideas of, like, what elements to be visualized, or, you know, he says something like, you know, I want something with dinosaurs. What can we get that will work with that?
Yeah.
And stuff like that. So into the actual development, production involves about 1,000 different artists and technicians, so it's a pretty intense production. Each segment is kind of handled like its own production, almost kind of like what they've been doing, really, with Snow White, we said. Very similar thing, where each major scene, you know, kind of had its own supervising director.
Yeah, and since these were in two distinct segments, it made even more sense.
Right, yeah, so, exactly. Now, the animation begins on the Sorcerer's Apprentice part in, like, 1938. And like I said, this is in production for a while before the rest of Fantasia. And as you were talking about earlier, the big thing here was that we have Fred Moore, who we talked about before. He was the lead animator on Lampwick in Pinocchio.
Mm-hmm.
He redesigns Mickey Mouse and notably gives him pupils. This is the design Mickey Mouse we have today, pretty much.
Yep.
Pretty much the same thing.
And the design did not debut with Fantasia.
Well, it didn't debut with Fantasia. It was created for Fantasia, but because, like I was talking earlier, they sort of delayed releasing Sorcerer's Apprentice to make these other segments and make a film out of it. So after this redesign was created, they already created other Mickey Mouse shorts and released them that had a new design. Mm-hmm. So people were actually already familiar with this version of Mickey, but it was created for, you know, it's almost kind of like with Steamboat Willie not being the first actually made Mickey Mouse short, right. It was the first distributed. Like you talked about earlier, Dopey was one point it considered for that role and everything like that. Just kind of jumping around here a little bit in, like, production notes. Art Babbitt is the person who animates the mushrooms in the Nutcracker suite segment.
Which is my second favorite part of this.
Yes, and we've been talking about him before. He was Evil Queen and Snow White and Geppetto in Pinocchio. Mm-hmm. He's a very famous animator at this time. He uses the Three Stooges as reference.
Yeah, which is, when you go into it with that knowledge, it's kind of apparent.
Yeah, exactly. You see that. The Rite of Spring segment, which is the one with the dinosaurs, was originally supposed to be much not longer, but like the scope was supposed to be a bit different. It was going to stretch into the era of humans.
Yeah, a they bit didn't more want to kind of upset
creationists. Yes. Exactly. So that kind of just becomes all a dinosaur thing.
And they did a lot of significant reorchestration to the Rite of Spring. Mm-hmm. Segments were moved, segments were cut. The original composer was not super thrilled with
it. I think
it.
He was the only, if I'm not right wrong, he was the only one who was still alive, yeah, of like anybody who composed a song.
He offered to work on it.
He offered to compose a new song, which like, doesn't really make sense.
We like Rite of Spring, you know, we're going with that. And yeah, he wasn't thrilled with what they did to
it. Not too shocking. So now then the Pastoral Symphony, is kind of this is the most censored one. At the time, too, and there's the female centaurs in it, and it opens with them bathing, and they are topless, but, like, there aren't nipples, for lack of a better word.
Yeah,
that's
pretty much, yeah, they just don't have nipples.
But they were actually originally drawn that way, and then it was changed.
Mm-hmm. Was it ever released that way?
No. Yeah, but what it was released with these small black centaur characters who kind of tended to the white centaurs that were pretty awfully racist. These were cut and never restored. There's going to be a lot of things that are cut from Fantasia and then eventually brought back. These are cut and gone.
Yeah, well,
no one's like, bring those back.
The shots are there. They're just zoomed in so that they're cropped out, basically.
Mm. Okay, see, I was actually wondering exactly how they did that.
So they took the shot because they were shining the hooves of the centaurs.
Yeah.
So they just zoomed it in and just cropped them out, basically.
It's better that way. One of the few times we're like, that's one.
Let's go with that.
You can go on YouTube and if you search for like cut Fantasia, you'll see it.
You'll find it,
and it's pretty bad, pretty interesting. Then you have the Night on Bald Mountain section, which is really a showpiece for Bill Tytla, and we talked about him before on the last episode because he was the one who animated Stromboli.
Yeah, we talked about how he was very gifted at kind of giving characters weights and kind of like an oomph that was very, very ethereal, but very apparent when you watch his animation.
Right, and you really see that in the Chernobog character in the Night on Bald Mountain part.
It's an interesting character because it's simultaneously rooted, but also has a ton of movement. I mean, the wingspan is part of that.
But it's not like Disney movement. It's very different.
Yeah.
I guess, especially, more so than anything else, that character in that segment is very different from anything else Disney has done. He actually also worked on Yensid. He's the animator responsible for that, because remember, there's actually a decent amount of time between these two, so yeah.
And the funny thing, too, is Yensid was originally the name for Chernobog.
Yeah, which makes the whole him, you know, being Disney spelled backwards thing a little funnier.
Right.
They're going to name the demon Yensid. Tells you a little bit about maybe some frustrations they might have had sometimes. A lot of sections were talked in, you know, when they were figuring out what songs they're going to put in the movie. Only one was, like, legit cut from the film. They had a section on a musical piece called Claire de Lune, and it was animated, but they cut it from the film, and this actually later shows up as a sequence in Make Mine Music called Blue Bayou. After the restaurant,
is it the same segment? Or
it's different. It's a little cut. I think you can find the full restored segment as a bonus feature on the DVD and Blu-ray.
Okay.
So you can find it on there. But yeah, so this was just completely cut from the film. I mean, the film's already like 2 hours long. So one of the big technical breakthroughs is Fantasound, which Disney develops for Fantasia. And it's basically a predecessor to what we kind of have today with surround sound. Because back then, almost all sound was just the mono, you know, speakers coming from behind the screen. And Disney really wanted to replicate the sound that you would get when you go to an actual orchestra. So what they do when they're recording the music for Fantasia, they got 33 microphones that capture the music onto 8 different audio tracks, which is, you know, a lot more than one. Then they add a 9th audio track, which is just like the ticking, so that the animators have their beats to kind of animate to. So now they have 9 audio tracks instead of one. And then, you know, they just kind of make this Fantasound system with the multi-speakers and stuff like that. And all of a sudden, you have surround sound, basically.
And I feel like getting to go see this in the original Fantasound would have been like today, us seeing Hobbit in high frame rate and D-box seats. Like, this wasn't a common thing.
Now,
14 theaters?
Something I have that, yeah, I have a little bit down here later. But, I mean, Fantasound is, it's kind of the movie's boon and bane. Because this obviously elevates the film tremendously, but keep in mind, if you want to show this movie, your theater has to get installed with Fantasound. Guess who's going to install Fantasound? Disney. And it's going to be at a cost for them. A fifth of the film's budget is basically spent on recording techniques and stuff like this. And they record the music with the Philadelphia Orchestra, and that takes about 7 weeks. Now, this section doesn't include Sorcerer's Apprentice, which they recorded earlier with a special soundtrack. Interesting, too, they seriously considered adding a Smell-O-Vision thing, too.
And I like what stopped them was that they didn't know how to clear the smell out of the room
Not that it was a bad idea, just like, well, we have a problem. And not that, like, they're already spending a lot of money on Fantasound. But they said, like, you know, they were going to have gunpowder during the Sorcerer's Apprentice and incense and the Ave Maria thing, and Might have been interesting.
But hey, flash forward, and you got PhilharMagic.
Oh, yeah, doing right. Doing it for real. I guess so. I wonder how they figured out how to disperse the smells.
Technology.
Oh, I guess it's because they just have like a little short burst of it coming from each seat. Yes,
not the whole theater.
Yeah, I guess that'd be harder. So, now, RKO is distributing all the Disney stuff at this point, but they did not want to widely release Fantasia for a few reasons. One, it was 2 hours and 5 minutes long with an intermission, which, you know, now that might not seem all that long, but back then...
Yeah, for sure.
Back then, that's pretty long. In fact, this is the only Walt Disney animated feature film that reaches the 2 hour mark.
And which I was a little surprised to hear that.
Well, there's some Pixar ones that do. I know Cars is over 2 hours long.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is the only Disney feature animated film that does. And it's also the longest Disney feature animated film. So, instead, Disney releases the movie as a sort of road show. And what that means is it's almost like. It's not too different from like a like when a show goes off Broadway and it tours, you know, like yeah. it sets up in a theater and it plays there for a while and then you can go see it. Except they can do this in multiple theaters at a time and it can run for a long time. There's a total of 13 road shows that are held across the United States in this first showing, and each involve 2 daily screenings with seat reservations booked in advance, but at higher prices. So it's almost like going to see an IMAX movie now. You're going to pay more to go see it. And the first roadshow opens at the Broadway Theater in New York City on November 3rd, 1940. So that's the release date of Fantasia, but again, it's not like with, you know, even Snow White and Pinocchio where, you know, there's not a wide release, at least right. Not at first. It's very different. But which kind of works for it in a way because it's like a big event film, you know. Everybody comes to see it. You can kind of get buzzed that way. But yeah, it's not like – it's very different from a widely released film. So Fantasia ran at the Broadway for 49 consecutive weeks, which was the longest run achieved by a film at that time. Its run continued for a total of 57 weeks until February 28, 1942. So it had a long run there especially. Some other places where it ran, ran at the Carthay Circle Theater in L.A., which mm-hmm. we know as the theater that premiered Snow White and also is the one that's now like the centerpiece of California Adventure theme park. Also, at the Fulton Theater in Pittsburgh, what I say for us is because we live 50 minutes away from Pittsburgh, now known as the Byam.
Yeah. In fact, don't tell my wife I'm taking her to see Little Mermaid there for her birthday.
That's funny. You're going to be in the theater where Fantasia was.
I didn't realize that about it. So, yeah, cool? That's exciting. See, you learned something.
It's cool, right. But again, each of these theaters had to be equipped with Fantasound. And again, Disney had to do that. So the road shows were popular, but the war, again, we kind of blame the war on Pinocchio's financial failings. Again, it's kind of coming back here a bit. The war made things difficult. Obviously, you didn't have that European distribution.
Mm-hmm.
But also, all but one of the Fantasound setups had to be dismantled and given to the war effort.
And then melted down for metal.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
That's what was going on at the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, RKO eventually takes over the road shows, but they're going to release the film in mono because they don't want to deal with the Fantasound thing anymore. Later, they will actually... release the film with a cut runtime, and the things they get rid of are all the commentary by Taylor in between the films, and they get rid of the Toccata and Fugue. Fugue. I don't say Fugue.
No, it's Fugue.
Toccata and Fugue. You're right, Toccata and Fugue. I just see all those U and E's, and I
just
get scared.
Don't get scared, just go
Toccata and Fugue. They cut that segment out, the opening segment, completely. Then at one point in 1982, they even just re-record the soundtrack with a different orchestra because the audio is deteriorated.
It's the first time in film history that an entire film soundtrack was digitally removed and replaced.
Right.
They also redubbed Deems Taylor.
Yeah, that's actually in there today still. Well, anyways, in 1990, they restore most of the film. Mm-hmm. They get the old soundtrack back because I don't think anybody liked that. But this is still a cut version of the film. In 2000, they restore the original roadshow version. And everything's back in except for the racist centaurs and Taylor's voice work. It had deteriorated beyond repair. So they actually bring in Corey Burton, who Disney fans will know.
He's Dale.
He's
Captain Hook in modern times.
And... does a lot of Disney voice work. So they bring him in, and he completely redubs the narration. And it kind of seems like it's a little... off. It's not distracting or anything. You might not really know.
I have to admit, I really didn't while I was rewatching it and before I kind of learned this fact. But there was like something about the Deems Taylor bits felt more modern to me than anything else in a weird way. And I wonder if that's part of why.
Well, The bits are interesting because...
But even like the way they were filmed, they didn't look like old film to me.
Well, again, part of that is because they've been pretty immaculately restored.
Yeah, which is good.
Which is good. But, so it's interesting just how many different versions of this film. And even today, we don't really have quite the same experience that people have when they saw this in 1940. But I do understand, too,
the soundtrack little bit, that is original Deems Taylor's voice still.
What's oh, really?
With the little animated line.
Oh, okay.
That part is still original. Part was okay.
From what I understand, they're still working on getting the original back, and maybe someday they will.
Well, even today, the surround sound mix you get at home doesn't really match the Fanta sound.
Fanta sound was its own thing.
No, but they had tried to match it in the original DVD re-release, where they actually tried to position these instruments in weird places. In the Blu-ray, it's a more conventional... music up front with reverb behind. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it's possible to at all emulate that Fanta sound experience. It'd be great if you could somehow. Right. But yeah, it's just kind of funny that like this is truly a film that the only way to experience it the way Walt Disney intended was to go to one of these shows in the 40s in a mm-hmm. true Fanta sound right. setup.
And that's kind of, you know, again, this is another film too that doesn't quite... It's, you know, it's kind of considered a flop, but it's a little different from the Pinocchio situation because the distribution is so unique and weird.
Yeah, it didn't have like a typical box office.
Right, and honestly, like the roadshows, you see, especially the New Year thing, they were doing well. The problem was that because of the war, you couldn't really keep that going forever. You never really got to the... I think the hope was that after the success of the roadshows, theaters would just start having Fanta sound in like as almost a thing, and then you can release Fantasia everywhere, and then you can bring it overseas. And of course, that doesn't happen because of the war.
Now, you know when the movie did get strangely popular?
What's that?
The 1960s.
Oh, right, yeah. And I
can't imagine why.
They very smartly, they even went out of their ways to market it as a psychedelic experience.
They went for it, yeah. Why not?
They did for sure.
It was, in fact, the early 1990s reissue on VHS that proved super popular, actually. Mm-hmm. And it was what actually gave them the confidence to move on with Fantasia 2000.
Right. So, yeah, there's quite a bit of a legacy here. Anyways, when it's out, it... obviously gets a lot of critical acclaim, more so from movie critics than music critics. Some music critics are a bit hard on it, as you can understand.
Well, and you know why?
Well,
think about it. A lot of the reasoning behind Fanta sound, and indeed the format...
Are you saying that they were threatened?
Well, sure.
You think?
You don't need the orchestra anymore. You don't need to go to the orchestra. The orchestra comes to you.
Well, you kind of have that a little bit today with like the Fathom special events, but still, obviously, people are going to rather go to the orchestra.
Right,
I think part of it was a little snootiness at Walt Disney's cartoons, and how could Stokowski bring himself down to this? So again, there's no animated... feature category yet, but Fantasia earns two honorary Oscars, actually in 1942. One for Fanta Sound. Fanta Sound earns an honorary Oscar. And Stokowski himself gets an honorary Oscar for the work he did on Fantasia. So, you know, isn't that nice?
Mm-hmm.
So two Oscars for Fantasia. One of honorary Oscars for Disney.
Well, they didn't know what to do with it.
They didn't really.
I think they understood that, you know, this important. Is important work, but it doesn't fit any paradigm that we have right now. So make something up and give him a statue, right. Please.
Well, yeah. Pinocchio at least actually won it, best...
song and soundtrack.
Soundtrack. But this isn't really a soundtrack. It's all old music.
Yeah.
Right. Now, Disney's original plan was for Fantasia to be kind of ongoing. The idea would be that there'd be a new edition released every few years, and you would kind of take out one segment and put a new one in. And,
much like a concert
series. Then the next time, that new segment's still in, but you take out another old segment and put a new one in, and that way Fantasia can kind of keep going. But the sort of weird reception to the film and the release problems stops that from happening. But some of the ideas that they thought about adding were Rider of the Valkyries by Richard Wagner, the Swan of Tuonela by Jean Sibelius, Invitation to the Dance by Carl Maria von Weber, and Flight of the Bumblebee by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov. So, you know, kind of one of those interesting what might have been. Another one, too, that they talked about for a bit is the Firebird suite, which we... Firebird.
2000, yeah.
Which we get.
Which is so good.
Which is...
We did get in one of the 60 theatrical reissues, they do add the Peter and the Wolf as, like... a feature short?
Well,
before, it's not technically.
It's the
part
closest
of
you get to the idea.
Yeah, it was like, you know, when we see shorts before a film today, it just kind of thematically fit, but it wasn't truly integrated into Fantasia.
It's weird to me that Peter and Wolf is that old.
Honestly, I have to admit,
not that old, but that like later.
Until I got more into this kind of knowledge and trivia, I always assumed Fantasia wasn't as old as it is.
No,
it doesn't feel like a 40s thing.
Well, it's so ambitious, it's hard to believe that it
this
was
his
that
third
early.
Movie. Yeah.
That, yeah, right? Yeah, it's crazy ambitious for what they're trying to do here, especially while they're basically making Pinocchio the same time as this.
Yeah.
So it's crazy. So yeah, that's kind of it on some of this interesting trivia and stuff about the production and the release. Again, just so many different versions of this film throughout the time. And I'm glad that we live in an era now where we kind of appreciate the original.
Yeah, it's funny how in the 80s, like, I'll just re-record this sound. It sounds bad. Right. Let's just redo it.
Look, we just cut these parts that are boring.
This won't sell.
Right. Now, it's nice that Fantasia is now... And you know what? They almost don't have to sell it as a commercial product as much anymore. I mean, they do, but people kind of know that Fantasia is a bit more artistic. Yeah, and people, I think, appreciate it for that. It's not necessarily the thing you're going to put on to entertain the four-year-old while you're babysitting him.
I'll say this, though. During the Nutcracker suite, so my wife is pregnant with twins.
What, are you going to say that your unborn twins enjoyed it?
They were... Oh, you can see them kicking around. I'm just saying.
Oh, my God.
I think they were dancing.
All right, that's fantastic. So that's it for this segment. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back, and we're going to kind of talk about our feelings on the movie. Go segment by segment.
All right.
You know, it's kind of hard to talk about Fantasia critically. It's kind of a daunting task because you almost feel like you need to have a sort of musical background that we don't necessarily have. I mean, we both played tuba in high school.
It's true.
So, you know, unless you need someone to go bump, 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 bump. We may not be the experts, so to say. But, you know, we can definitely talk about it and how we appreciate it as Disney fans and through the animation and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
What do you think? So, before we get into the series, what do you think about the format? I like the live action
cut. Well, again,
I
think it's that attempt to simulate a true concert experience.
Right, but I like that there's something abstract about it. There's the shadows, the kind of the backgrounds and stuff like that is weird. And I loved it. I love the master of ceremonies. I think it's kind of a...
It's classy.
He is classy. That's a good way of putting it. And, you know, I love that it's almost a little informal. Like, there's that one section where, like, they're just doing the narration and someone just drops wind chimes.
Yeah, I never understood that part.
I like it. It's like,
why did that happen?
Is there
any explanation for that anywhere?
I think the idea is that just like in an actual concert,
something usually goes wrong.
Somebody drops something or something. It just makes it feel a bit more real because otherwise it's a little scripted and too perfect, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, oh, that's very interesting.
So yeah, that kind of stuff's interesting. So let's go through this segments here. First one, we got my phonetic rival here, Toccata and Fugue in
there
D minor.
There you go.
By Johann Sebastian Bach. Now, this is very different from most of them. It actually starts off as a live-action piece with, again, playing with shadows and stuff like that.
Now, that was not the actual orchestra they filmed.
No, it wasn't. But yeah, so it's a lot of shadows and color play, and then the animation is all very abstract here. And it's kind of interesting. You know what? It almost reminds me of, remember, like, back when you had, like, Windows Media Player, and it had, like, those things.
The visualizers.
It's like a visualizer.
That's what it kind of is,
It's different, except it's a handmade visualizer. And it's really neat. There's no plot so much to follow. And they even say that this is about the abstract idea of music, and this is just about visualizing that in an interesting way.
Colors and shapes that go through your mind as you listen.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Again, this probably appealed to the 60s audience very much.
And again, I think it was a good way to start it off a little bit, you know, kind of transition from a traditional watching orchestra to these images begin to kind of flutter about. So I liked that. Then the next one's the Nutcracker Suite by
Peter Eluchakowski.
Thank you. Thank you for throwing that lifeline out there. And this is when it gets really interesting. And what I like about this segment is that it does not immediately look like a Pinocchio or a Snow White.
No.
You have those fairies. They do not have the Disney proportions. They're,
Naked. There's a lot of nudity in this film.
Yeah, kind of a little naked. Yeah. So yeah, I just like the look of this, and it kind of like Pinocchio too. A lot of cool particle effects in this one with particle effects animation.
Yes,
is what I mean. But yeah,
yes. But no, it's interesting because they could have gone
particle effects.
Yeah,
it's not like the computer, but
they could have gone the easy route and just kind of done the story of the Nutcracker suite here. Yeah. But they take it into a very different direction. And it's interesting because this segment itself is comprised of many segments. Because right. The music segment.
Right, and this is the suite, so it's all the kind of best hits of the Nutcracker.
Right, right.
Was it a ballet? Right?
Yeah.
Is that what you call it, a ballet? Yeah, yeah. So, you get the fairies in the beginning, they're doing a little ice skating thing, and then you,
They're doing the seasons.
Right, and then you have the kind of, and, you know, in the original thing, the whole point was that there's, like, the different nationalities doing the dances for the kids.
Uh-huh.
So that's why you have, like, the kind of Chinese mushrooms.
I love those mushrooms. Those mushrooms, I don't know
funny.
Why.
The animation on that is very funny. It's cute. You have, like, the little one is kind of always out of place.
He's like, hey, yeah. Guys, how's it going?
Yeah, it's right. I like it, too, how, like, there's, like, a spotlight on it even, you know?
That moves with the scene. It's mm-hmm. It's a very neat effect when you really watch it.
And you just kind of, you have just, like, that, I don't know, just completely draws your attention in there. And it's just very much looking at that animation.
Mm-hmm.
Very well done. Then, you know, you go on from there, you have the flowers doing the Russian dance.
Which is, it's a great kineticism to mm-hmm. that segment. I don't know what it is about it, but it's very appealing.
Mm-hmm. Then, yeah, so, and then you kind of end back with the snowflake fairies are weird, aren't they?
Well, it's funny, because there's snowflakes for a little bit, and then there's fairies in the snowflakes, and they even kind of look like, how'd I get this snowflake?
Yeah, they look out. I can't tell if it's quite, like, elegant spinning, or...
There's like, get me out of this thing!
Well, yeah, it's interesting, because they're kind of superimposing it on there, and, it looks different. It's neat, though.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the Nutcracker suite. Then we get The Sorcerer's Apprentice by Paul Dukas? Dukas? Dukas.
We'll go with that.
Paul Dukas.
100%. The Sorcerer's Apprentice as a kid was, like, my favorite thing ever.
Well, it's great. Cause
it's just so good.
Because it's
everything
Mickey.
About it. This kind of goes to the greater point of Fantasia. But I feel like a lot of people think, like, oh, kids get bored by this, blah, blah, blah. But on the contrary, I think it's kind of great for kids because... The stories are not complicated. There's no dialogue.
Well,
so they kind of...
In a way, yeah.
You know, you can follow it. You know exactly what's going on.
Well, I like about this, too. This is a time where you have Mickey with a personality. He's kind of mischievous, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of being bad.
Yeah, he's not a goody-two-shoes in this at all.
No.
I mean, when he takes the axe to the broom, it's kind of violent.
Right. I think, that's interesting, too, because originally they were just going to show him... chopping them up, and they're like, this is a bit much.
Yeah.
Shadows. Let's do this. Shadows. Hooray. But, so this is obviously a very iconic section, and always very fun to watch. The whole him on the top of the mountain.
It's just the greatest thing. It really is.
So after that, you have the Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky. A lot of Russian people. You think... Yeah.
Yeah, they compose a lot of music.
Mm-hmm. So this is another very un-Disney one.
Mm-hmm. There's a few live action references.
And yeah, you kind of start off with like the primordial ooze, and we get full on that for really the first and really only time until Dinosaur. We have Disney doing dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's not like a cartoon Disney dinosaur. These things look like dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Except, you know, it looks pretty realistic. Except for, like, the T-Rex. He looks... They, like, tried really hard to make him look like an evil T-Rex.
Yeah, he's got red eyes.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. So this is... Yeah, this is an intense segment, too. I mean, you have the T-Rex killing that other dinosaur, you know?
Yeah, he gets him. He gets him good. But it's also very powerful, too. Like, even before the dinosaurs come, just like the whole birth of the Earth, the effects animation on, like... the exploding lava bubbles.
Yeah, I love that.
Looks really, really good. Mm. Like, that had to be... I mean, what are you going out the lava fields to research it? Like, that's really impressive,
mm-hmm.
the way they did that.
Right, and then you kind of have, like, the sad, slow dinosaur march of death at the end.
Yeah.
Again,
it's like Land Before Time without the happy ending.
This one is pretty intense, except for, like, Bald Mountain. This is the most intense one in a lot of ways.
Because it doesn't have a happy ending. Yeah, the dinosaurs, they're dead.
They don't make it so much. After that, we have the intermission.
Yeah, it's very abrupt, too. I always forget it's coming, too. Just like, we'll now have a 15 intermission, and it's like,
I love that they keep it in the releases today, though.
Yeah, and then that's when the title card even finally comes up, which is so
and I love too, like,
so bizarre,
before the intermission really ends, where people got back there, there's like that little jam session.
Yeah,
which again is not the Philadelphia Orchestra. That's actually the orchestra that they filmed for the stuff.
Right.
And that's again, that's a little nice thing to add some personality.
Yeah, it's fun.
To it. So then we have the Pastoral Symphony by Ludwig van Beethoven. Him I know how to pronounce. looking into this isn't my favorite segment.
It's long.
It's long.
I'll give you that.
It feels very long.
It does feel long.
It goes on. You like feel like it's about to end with the Bacchus stuff. And then Zeus kind of shows up and does this whole thing.
I do like Zeus. He's like, you know, what's this barrel of tomatoes?
Zeus is weird. He's
like,
creepy.
I'm just going to throw some lightning bolts at y'all.
it's interesting because we have Hercules to compare this to and a lot of the similar characters. Bacchus is actually literally the same character. They just use that design.
Yeah.
But, it's interesting because, like, you have this very different interpretation of Zeus. And that's this kind of,
well, it's probably closer to the actual Greek mythology. He was a jerk.
Just being like a dick, being kind of like, whatever. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff about this weird. Whereas some of the other ones felt very un-Disney, this one feels very Disney.
Very Disney.
The proportions, the kind of cutesiness of it is very Disney. And you have like the weird like matchmaking thing going on with the Cupids. The little Cupids creep me out.
Hey, they're wingmen.
Yeah, they freak me out.
Oh, come on, that's a great pun. You didn't even catch it.
They're wingmen. They're
because they have wings.
Okay, I get you. the one's butt even turns into a heart as he's peeking in on God knows what.
Oh, I think we all know what he's peeking in on.
It's a little weird.
That's strange.
Like the opening bit with like the cute little Pegasus learning to fly is kind of nice.
Very marketable.
Yeah, I guess that's like, there's something kind of safe. And it's also the one where, you know, obviously we're taking liberties with the music, and it's the one I think a lot of the critics were most like, iffy about. Even Tchaikovsky himself was a little bit like, we're doing what with the Pastoral Symphony? It's about Greek mythology now? Okay. Right. So, yeah, not that it's awful. It's obviously it has some beautiful animation and stuff like that, but not my favorite. And then we have Dance of the Hours by the hell with me. Amalcari Ponchielli. I think that's pretty close.
Yeah, good enough.
And this is a straight-up ballet.
I love this one.
See, this one, again, is not one of my favorite ones.
What I like about it is it's the contrast. You have this very graceful form of dance being performed by hippos and elephants.
Right.
Who are still strangely graceful in the performance.
Yeah, in their own way.
So it's all very contrasting.
I think I heard that they got some, like, fat lady to be a model for the hippo, which is kind of funny.
That's degrading.
You know what's funny? You always remember the ostriches and the hippos and the alligators. No one remembers the elephants.
Yeah, the elephants kind of...
Elephants don't do
whatever.
Much here.
We got Dumbo.
Maybe it's because Dumbo's coming pretty shortly after this.
I don't know why. I like the design of the alligators. They just
look cool to me for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get the finale sequence. Night on Bald Mountain by Modest Mussorgsky. And Ave Maria by Franz Schubert.
Now, apparently they got a lot of complaints about how scary this is, and rightfully so, because this scared the crap out of me.
It is.
It's terrifying.
This is the best part of the film, I think.
Oh, for sure. But even watching it now,
it's fascinating.
It's scary.
It's scary, but
it's unsettling.
It is incredibly insane, and they do some things with the animation that I know how they did it in a way.
It's just that the scale of it for whatever reason. I mean, it's just drawings, but it has this very interesting scale because, like, parts of it take place on Chernobog's hand, and for some reason, like, that really works.
It's like, even when the scene is just Chernobog, you still get his presence, the hugeness of it. And
who
just
lives in that town?
Yeah, honestly, poor guys. But just, like, the way the specters look when they're riding through the air.
Yeah, because the way they're ambient, they almost look like chalk.
Exactly. They have a chalky, ethereal look to them.
Yeah, there's no hard lines to them.
And they did, like, this weird thing where, like, they're kind of floating across the screen in this really weird way. It's unsettling, and it's great. Best part of the film. And then that immediately, so they come, this is the only time they combine two songs in one segment, and you go into the Ave Maria, which is just, it's a nice contrast. You know, in the middle, you have the bells tolling.
Yeah, and that kind of...
It's one of the few. I think it's like, I think it's the only time where there's a sound element in any of the sequences that isn't just the orchestra. And even here, I bet the orchestra just played the bells.
Well, the only exception being in Dance of the Hours, they added a bass drum when the hippo falls.
Well, yeah, but what I mean is that there's not, like, there's no, like, sound effects. Obviously, there's no dialogue, but there's no other, like, sound.
I see what you're saying.
You know what I mean? Like, the sound is completely from these scores. So Ave Maria is just kind of this slow march of lanterns. Then it ends with, like, this long panning shot into a forest. Interestingly, originally that final shot was going to be in a cathedral with, you know, and literally showing stained glass pictures of Maria. Like, they kind of shy away from this. They didn't want to get too religious. Which is weird, because it's Ave Maria.
Yeah.
Some people now retroactively criticize the film for that, for not kind of ending on that note. Because, even the final shot, it is kind of like, well, why are we focusing on this forest? So all of a sudden, okay, the end.
Yeah.
I guess one of the problems with Ave Maria is that it's the counterpoint of Nine on Bald Mountain, and it's nice and that, like, oh, this is nice and quiet. But Nine on Bald Mountain was so powerful, it's a hard act to follow in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But some of the shots of the marching lanterns do look incredible, and one of them is actually the longest multi-point camera shot there was. So, yeah, very interesting.
Well, that, and is that the shot I'm thinking of, that, like, they had to do it three times, because the first time they had the wrong lens,
apparently
there was an earthquake.
Yeah, they had a lot of bad luck. Well, when you're doing a long multi-point camera shot, when something comes on the cells, you gotta start over.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so what is your favorite segment, then? We went through them all.
I mean, my favorite is Sorcerer's Apprentice, for sure.
See, I like Nine on Bald Mountain.
That's my second
favorite. I love Nine on Bald Mountain. That stuff looks great. And if there was one that wasn't your favorite, the least favorite part? Pastoral?
Yeah, the pastoral. Yeah,
if it was like half its length, I'd be able to tolerate a little bit more. But it feels so long. It feels safe and long.
Yeah, I think that's what it's because, like,
it feels like a silly symphony.
Yeah, everything else seems to be breaking ground in some way. And this is like, you're right. It's like just a kind of super silly
symphony. Dance of the Hours a little bit too is, again, almost just kind of like a nice silly symphony. But there's something more creative about it.
Yeah, like I said, I like the juxtaposition of Dance of the Hours.
Or Pastoral Symphony is just, you know, bit much there. All right, so we've been reviewing these. We've been giving these things a number. This one's hard. You know, it's funny, because we keep talking about the package films coming up.
Yeah.
This is kind of a package film in that there's a lot of segments to it. I guess, I almost want to say a 93, if you want to give Fantasia a number.
I don't know
if I like it quite as much, ultimately, as Snow White or Pinocchio.
No.
It's something more you watch every once in a while.
You watch for an appreciation, not so much for
the entertainment. And not that it's not entertaining. It is entertaining, and it is beautiful. And it's a film I can watch probably 50 times in my lifetime and always kind of get something out of it.
Right.
All right, then. So that's it for a little review. We're going to take another break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about Fantasia's influence in the theme parks. So see you in a bit.
So obviously when one of the major segments of your film involves Mickey Mouse,
right,
the presence will be felt in the theme parks. Right.
And I love how Sorcerer Mickey has become Mickey's, like, final form.
Yes.
It's
yes.
Like he's all powered up.
For sure.
Right. So it's like when you see Sorcerer's Hat Mickey, you know that stuff's about to get real.
Yes. So until very recently, Sorcerer Mickey's hat was, in fact, the main icon of Disney's Hollywood Studios.
Going down as we record this, don't know when we released this
podcast. Yeah, they started taking it down January 7th of 2015. They announced this past October that they were taking it down. It was originally erected in 2001 as part of the 100 Years of Magic celebrating Walt Disney's 100th birthday. At the time, underneath the hat was an interactive kiosk that you could learn kind of
like
Walt Disney trivia and information. Eventually became kind of a pin trading booth.
I guess that's kind of the thing. Is like, you know, the icon in Magic Kingdom is, you know, the castle, and it's got a nice restaurant in it, and Epcot has this incredible ride, and Jim Studios, Hollywood Studios, has the pin trading station.
Yeah. Under you know, there. They had used the Eiffel Tower, but then they also had the Chinese theaters.
See,
and
now for me, I never remember the Chinese theater being a lot of merch. Well, I remember the Eiffel Tower being on
it. Yeah, because they didn't technically own it. They wanted it to be something they owned.
Right. I think the idea of making the hat an icon could have worked more if it was that designed that way in the beginning.
It just felt makshift.
And it looked a little makeshift.
When they first put it up, like, it looked temporary, but that was okay. Because, like, it was like, oh, they're putting it here for this, you know, two-year celebration they're doing. And then it just never went away.
Right.
I don't know, because, you know, like, it wasn't... When you looked at it, it was, like, kind of perforated. Like, it wasn't solid.
Yeah, like, you could see the sections of it.
Yeah, it just always felt like it was just dropped there.
A little bit.
So, it's, you know...
I don't think we're mourning its loss too terribly.
No, it was there. We appreciated it. I'm glad to have the kind of classic view of the Chinese theater coming back as you walk into the park.
And if you want to replace it again, then do something a bit, I don't know, more permanent.
And something that fits the theme. You know,
maybe someday they're going to retheme that whole building, and maybe that's fine, but yeah. Especially now that we know they're probably going to be making a lot of changes to the ride itself. So.
Yeah, well, Disney Hollywood Studio in its entirety seems to be going through a lot of changes, as the rumors suggest.
I'm sure. Well, once we finally hear more about Star Wars Land, then I'm sure will happen.
But anyway, we digress.
Yes, yeah.
The other, of course, big presence at Hollywood Studios and Disneyland Park is Fantasmic. Features, Chernabog has his segment inside Fantasmic.
In the Disneyland. Does he have one in the Disney World?
Yeah, in both.
Oh, you're right, you're right.
And of course the finale of Fantasmic is Sorcerer Mickey on top of the mountain, shooting stars, crashing water. I mean, it's literally, I kind of start to cry every time this happens.
I know, like, I get chills every time.
I do, because
it's awesome.
I mean, I'm tearing up right now thinking about it.
Come
on. I know, I like it a lot because, again, you take that thing that from my childhood was like, this was like iconic Mickey Mouse me, and it literally is happening in front of you.
It is. It is always,
it's so
it's
great.
Always cool to see, especially.
Oh, it's
in,
so good.
It's, you know, you can argue which version's better, but I do like the Hollywood Studios version. He's literally on top of that mountain.
Yeah,
he's pretty high up there too. It's pretty
intense. So good.
And the way he kind of teleports back up and down. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
The most direct Fantasia. Influence in Disney World is the Fantasia Gardens mini golf course.
So which is a fun thing.
It's super great. I mean, Disney does this fun thing with all their mini golf courses where it kind of funnels into the hole.
It's on easy mode.
Yes. So everyone can, you know, have fun with it.
It has a short hole too, doesn't it?
Yeah, the Fantasia Fairways, which is the more challenging, less kind of theme parky golf. Uh-huh. And we haven't been there in a while, I feel like. I feel like we tend to go to Winter Summerland when we do the mini golf these days.
Right, yeah. I always do like to go mini golf at least once. I don't know if it's something everybody does, but they're fun courses.
They're very fun.
And Fantasia Gardens, like, you know, everything's themed after Fantasia, and they kind of go through the segments.
Yeah, there's a great hole where it's in front of like a row of the brooms dumping water, and as the ball goes past, water shoots out the buckets, and, you know, it's very whimsical.
It's very whimsical. It's very fun, very well done. It is a Disney mini golf course.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you have Mickey's Philhar Magic, which kind of has the kind of orchestra theme, and he's got the hat that Donald steals.
And they have the broomsticks in that for a little bit.
Mm-hmm. That's actually a great part in that, because of the stomping and the whole theater kind of echoes
and everything.
Oh, right,
yeah.
And we have the smell-o-vision.
Yeah, there
so
you go.
There it is.
Dreams come true.
Yes, finally they do. During Spectro Magic, it was all Spectro Magic.
Spectro Magic.
Yeah, you had Chernabog, and you had the Flying Pegasus as part of the parade.
Although Chernabog never worked very often.
He was often missing, which always bummed me out, because that was my favorite part.
Because it was cool, because he would like go from being the mountain to being Chernabog.
Yeah,
it would play the music.
Exciting.
It was sweet.
And kind of the last thing, it's a very subtle, hidden thing, but in the lobby of the Grand Floridian, there is a statue of Mickey Mouse shaking hands with Stokowski.
Right, which is a very nice part of that film.
Yeah, and it has, like, the little plaque says, like, I wanted to offer my congratulations, sir. That's really good. I mean, it was silhouette, so it kind of helps. Very good blend of animation and live action, I always thought.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah, so,
there's a lot of kind of general fan... There's, like, a weird... A lot of the lobby of Contemporary, although I think they've redone it, I haven't been back
since. Yeah, they have.
It used to have a feeling that was very reminiscent of the sort of opening of Fantasia.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, Sorcerer's Mickey hats are everywhere in Disney World.
We had his hand, too, and a wand, which he never actually had, on Epcot for a bit there.
Does that count?
I don't know. Maybe not.
Nah.
I don't know. He had a wand. So sorcerers have wands, although he didn't in the thing. I don't know, that thing was awful anyways. We don't want to attribute it to Fantasia.
Let's not talk about that any more than we have to.
Right.
I'm always surprised. I wish there was more Yen Sid in the parks.
Well, Yen Sid himself has been showing up a lot in the games media.
Right, of all things. I want to talk with Yen Sid.
He's been an important character in the Kingdom Hearts games, in the Epic Mickey games, yeah. And in that Fantasia video game.
Mm-hmm.
Which didn't have a whole ton to do with Fantasia, but hey.
It had a couple of the songs, not couple. Sorcerer's Apprentice. Or yeah, right. I still don't get that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, that's kind of the
run. So yeah, there's like no like Fantasia ride per se.
Like what would that
be? Yeah, exactly, right. But yeah, no, it kind of.
Oh yeah, I forgot too. You do have Sorcerer Mickey in the Great Movie Ride.
Oh yeah, that's right. You go
past it. It's just the looping animation of him shooting stars.
You know, I think that segment, I read this recently. That area right there was supposed to be another Wizard of Oz thing. It was supposed to be the tornado. You can kind of see how it would be there. Because I think that is right after it.
Yeah, and then that makes sense. And then
they threw Sorcerer Mickey in there instead.
Yeah, works for me.
Interesting, huh?
Again, my favorite.
All right then. I guess that's that. We'll take another short break, and we're going to close this thing off.
All right.
You know, I was a little nervous about tackling Fantasia.
There's a lot to it.
Yeah. Makes me wonder just how nervous Walt Disney was when he had to tackle Fantasia.
Yeah, we just had to talk about it for an hour.
Right, yeah. But, man, just an interesting film to look at. And there's so much you can say. And there's a lot you can read about Fantasia. I know there's a giant book that was made at one point that, I will link to in the show notes that has a lot into the minutiae of the production.
They also just recently released the Fantasia Legacy Collection soundtrack, which is a 4-disc collection. Most of the Legacy ones are 2, but this is a 4-disc collection of the original recordings and some different takes and things like that.
That's very cool. But yeah, so Fantasia is a film that people will be talking about for probably another 80 years or so.
Another forever, I'd say.
Yeah, as long as people are talking about film. So, that's 3 down. Next week, we'll be going into Dumbo Land.
That sounds wrong.
Why? We are.
We're going to the Storybook Circus.
Oh, sure. Okay, yeah. Casey Jr. Yeah. All right.
So, in the meantime, you can check us out at worldofdisneyanimation.com. From our website, you can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, RSS, and a bunch of other ways. So if you've got a podcast app, you can listen to us, which you're probably doing right now. You can also reach out to us on Twitter, at WODA Podcast, and by email at wodapodcast@gmail.com, or using the contact form on our website, which is placed there for your convenience. Until then, keep watching Disney movies.
Yeah, I know we will be for a while.
That is very true of us.
Bye, everybody.